Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. We'll begin by answering questions, mine and yours, as we approach the final days before the 2015 income tax filing deadline. There is some good news. We have 3 extra days to file this year. The deadline falls on April 18th nationally. With me in studio is Lance Weiss, CPA and partner with SFW Partners LLC. We'll take your calls at 382-8255. Lance, thanks so much for being with us.
Don, thanks for having me. I think it's probably a good thing that the beer people follow the tax guy. It's a natural progression.
There is a linkage. There is no question about it. Well, I mentioned the good news, a little extra time for filing, but it's even better for this part of the country.
You know, well, it's different. I don't know if it's better or not, but everyone remembers the flooding that we had in and around the St. Louis and really throughout Missouri in December and January. And because of that flooding, the area and most of the state was declared a federal disaster zone. So if you're a resident of St. Louis City, St. Louis County, St. Charles County, and a dozen or so other counties in Missouri, your due date for the federal and the Missouri individual income tax returns and businesses, most business returns, to both file and pay your taxes is actually May 16th. So they tacked on roughly another month because of the federal disaster zone status.
Well, that should be helpful to a lot of people who fell victim to those floods.
Oh, it certainly is. And yeah. For some of those, the month won't even help because the records are just gone. But it does give you a little more time to pull together what you can. And you know, if you've been financially wiped out, to pull together the wherewithal to pay whatever might be due. I know in our practice it hasn't really changed too much of what we'll be doing, because if you're due a refund, you still want to file as soon as you can. But for those who owe, it's a nice benefit to have that extra month.
For those of us who are shooting for April 18th, where should we be right now in assembling our material?
Well, you know, by now the 1099s have all come in. You've had your W-2 now for more than a month. The 1099s from the brokerage companies have come out, and we're seeing fewer of the corrected 1099s this year than we have in the past. Although they mailed the first set out a little bit later, there does seem to be fewer corrections coming out as well. So by now you should have most of that information gathered up and start to assemble all the charitable deductions and track down your personal property tax bill and things like that.
Time's a-wasting,
as
they say. One other issue I wanted to get to, it's been coming up for the last couple of years, is the question of fraud. Have any improvements been made in protecting us taxpayers?
There have been. And the identity theft is a constant issue. Certainly by filing your return earlier, you're more likely to beat the criminal to your Social Security number so that then you can get your refund faster. But that doesn't prevent the identity theft from happening. It just prevents you from finding out about it. So the crook might now have your Social Security number, and while they can't do anything, nefarious with your income tax refund, they can certainly go do some other stuff with it. So filing early can be a great idea to get that refund without the significant delay that happens if it has been hacked. But then it might be a long time until you find out that it actually happened. So there's another side to that coin.
And if it does happen, is the taxpayer protected?
The taxpayer is protected. So from the IRS, you won't actually lose your refund. You will eventually get the money back that is due to you, that was paid in through your estimated payments or by your employer or however the money went in. If you actually owe less tax than that, you will get your refund. But Don, I tell you, it takes forever to get those refunds back sometime. I still have a few clients waiting for their 2014 refunds after the identity theft.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, there are so many people out there who are using this technology for their own purposes. It's
a lot of crooks out there who can wear their slippers. They don't.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. And their pajamas. They can
That's
do it
exactly
all in their
right.
pajamas. Okay, let's talk about changes this year. Any new twists and turns for us this year?
Well, what they did near the end of the year was they extended a lot of the provisions that businesses always have to wrestle with. What will be the first year equipment write-off for depreciation, and will we get bonus depreciation and those sorts of things. And they actually passed a real good piece of legislation that's a multi-year program that says these are the rules and they will be the rules now for several more years. On the individual side, the one we see a lot in our practice deals with those individuals who are 70 and a half and they are required to take money from their IRA plans because of the required minimum distribution rules. And what the taxpayer can do now is have that money paid directly from their IRA custodian to the charity of their choice. And when that happens, they don't have to pick up the income from their IRA distribution. And, you know, many taxpayers, when they take that money out of their IRA, it increases their adjusted gross income. When it increases that adjusted gross income, it causes more of their Social Security benefit to be subject to tax. Mm. Well, if they can have that amount from the IRA go directly to the charity, then their income isn't increased by that threshold and less of their Social Security is often subject to tax. And then there are some other benefits on the other end of the spectrum for the very high-income individuals because it reduces the amount of their other deductions that are subject to phase-out. So it's a great rule. And what Congress has done to us so many, probably three of the last 4 years, is they said you can do it, but we're not going to tell you until December that you can do it. You could have done it for the last 11 months. Well, now we know what the rules are, and we know that we can do it for all of calendar 16. So just to have a set of rules is a nice change from what we've had in the past.
Am I misinterpreting something I read? I thought I had seen that Congress has the right and the potential for changing tax laws for 2015 right up until the 18th of April, if you will.
Well, they can, and they have before, and they've done it to the taxpayers' detriment, and they've done it before to the taxpayers' benefit. I mean, I remember right after 9/11, they changed the depreciation rules in March for the prior calendar year. So, you know, that was one where they assisted business with an after-the-fact law change, and we've seen it happen the other way where they've increased rates after the fact.
And, of course, if you've already filed and they change things, that just complicates everything.
There is always a process for an amended return, and you have generally until 3 years from the date you filed your first return to go ahead and get that amended. And certainly if there's a change that's a benefit, you'd want to amend.
Well, now that we know that Obamacare and the IRS are linked at the hip, if you will, is there anything with regard to Obamacare this year that taxpayers should know about?
Well, there are. There are a few new forms out there that almost everyone will receive a copy of, and that's the new form 1095A. Mm-hmm. And if you get your insurance from the exchange, from healthcare.gov, you'll get a form 1095A, and it'll have on there all of the information regarding who in your household was covered, what was your total premium cost, how does that premium cost compare to what's called some sort of a national average that's based on the second best plan available, and then what your premium credit is. So there's a new form 1095A from healthcare.gov, and then you'll use that information to reconcile your premium credit on a form 8965. You know, the thing I can tell you about those forms are that get a piece of software. You know, do your return online or with one of the many good products that are out there at the office depots of the world where you can buy the tax software, because I know I wouldn't want to try to do those forms by hand anymore.
Are your partners at SFW going to be happy with hearing you say that?
You know, we're all really actually pretty big fans of the software. And there's enough complexity out there in the tax law that CPAs are always going to be needed. But to the extent that, you know, your return is pretty basic, I'm a big fan of the TurboTax type programs.
One other thing about Obamacare, the penalty situation has changed a little bit this year, hasn't it?
It has. The penalty increases a little bit each year. And so now if you just choose not to get insurance, your penalty can be – it's the greater of – and I don't have all these things committed to memory, but it's the greater of 2% of your adjusted gross income. Or I think it's up to $695 or $495 per family. You know, with our client base, we often see that 2% penalty kick in. So it can be a substantial cost not to have insurance.
I have a number of questions, but our listening audience does too. So let's get right to that. We'll bring in Mike. He's calling from Maryland Heights. Mike, you're on the air with Lance Weiss.
Yes, thank you. I was wondering if you could tell me what has a greater impact on making somebody eligible for AMT? Is it deductions or crossing an income threshold? Or how does that work?
That's sure. The alternative minimum tax.
Right. So the alternative minimum tax, and it's actually a little bit of both. I mean, if you're on a married return and your income is under roughly $100,000, we almost never see the alternative minimum tax kick in. But if you have income, we often see it come into play between that 100 and say 400,000 and 500,000 range. So it's a big number, but you know, we're in a big metropolitan area, and there are a lot of families, two income families, where 100 to 400 is not an unheard of amount of income. For those families, what will throw you into the AMT more often than not are your the number of kits, the number of dependents you have, because that's a deduction that's allowed for the regular tax, but it's not allowed for AMT. And then your estate tax deduction, so how much Missouri tax you have paid in, can affect it. Your real estate tax. So if you're in a big house with a lot of kids, your chance of being subject to the AMT goes up. So it's a combination of both. But then once your income gets up over that $500,000 or so threshold, you're in that regular tax bracket of 39.6, where the AMT bracket tops out at 28%. So as more of your income is subject to that higher bracket, you tend to get out of that AMT bubble.
Okay, thanks for the call, Mike. Again, we're encouraging calls. If you have them for Lance Weiss, give us a call at 38255. I received, this is an email that we have here. I received tax documents months ago. I had health insurance, but they came really late, the documents, in mid-March. Do I have to include those in my filing, or do I keep them in case the IRS follows up with questions? I ask because I already sent my tax documents to my preparer, and I don't know if I need to send these separately.
Right. So we talked about the form 1095A that will come from the healthcare.gov. There's also a form 1095B and a 1095C that will come from your health insurance company or from your employer if your employer has a self-insured, you know, very large group type plan. For the 1095Bs and Cs, you don't need those to actually prepare your income tax return. But it is important to keep those because that is your proof and your evidence that you actually had health coverage during the entire year and you don't owe the penalty. So if it's a form 1095B or C that was received, just keep it in your file and no need to do anything with it. But if it is a form 1095A, you'll want to check that information with the form 8965 that was included with your return you filed a month or so ago.
And how long do you want to keep those files that you're storing?
Well, you know, I generally keep all the tax information at least 3 years. And if it's information that relates to an asset purchase, a home purchase, or anything that you might use in your business, you'll want to keep the records related to that purchase until you sell the asset, actually probably until 3 years after you sell the asset. But generally, 3 years is a pretty good guideline. We've got – I'll throw out a plug and a promo here. At our website, we have a list that says here's a sample checklist on how long to keep various tax documents. So, and those are out there all over the inner world, inner web.
Right. You're listening to Lance Weiss. He's a CPA, and we're talking taxes. We'll come back and continue the conversation. We'd like to get you into it. Give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org, or if you'd prefer to send a tweet, we'll take that at STL on air. Back with Lance Weiss in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Let's get right to the listeners, Lance. We have some calls. I'd like to get to them. We'll begin with Tricia, who's calling from Edwardsville. Go ahead, Tricia.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Yes, my question has to do with an irrevocable trust. My mother-in-law set up a trust before she passed away with my husband as trustee. After she passed away, we took possession of that money. And now we have gotten a form for this year. It's a 1099-R, and we did pay taxes on that money, and this document shows that. The question is, where do we file that? I can't seem to get an answer of, does my husband file it as part of his taxes, or do we have to do something special?
Okay. So chances are something a little bit special, but there'll be a few more facts we're going to need. A 1099-R is going to come from a retirement plan that she had or maybe an annuity that she owned. And that program, that document, that investment account, whatever it ends up being, had a listed beneficiary. And let's just make the assumption that it was her IRA account. So her IRA listed a beneficiary. if the beneficiary was the irrevocable trust, then that income first goes into the trust, which will report it on a Form 1041. But then since you and your husband took the cash out, then that irrevocable trust will issue a K-1, most likely to your husband since that's the lineage here. And that K-1 will report the income, and it actually ends up on your Form 1040. So there's another question and another document there. And the other way to look at it would be, what is on the 1099-R? There will be a federal ID number and a recipient there. And if the name on that document is your mother-in-law's irrevocable trust, then you will need to do a Form 1041. If instead that just has your husband's name, then it just goes right on your 1040.
Okay. It is the irrevocable trust.
Okay.
I just didn't know, can't figure out how to fill out the 1041 because I don't have the information it asks for.
Yeah. Somewhere there'll be a trust document, and that trust document will name who the trustee is. And it's up to the trustee to help you do that Form 1041. Chances are it could either be your mother-in-law's attorney, or she may have named her son your husband. It'll depend on what her document says.
Yeah, it's him. He's the trustee.
Okay.
So in other words, I'm responsible for it.
Well, he is technically,
okay.
But yeah, it sounds like it's going to fall on you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay.
For those who don't know, what is an irrevocable trust?
Well, an irrevocable trust is a document that an individual writes, and they say, I'm going to put this asset or I'm going to name this beneficiary in this account, and I can't change it. So whatever goes in there, I've made this completed gift, and now that asset is not included in my estate. And, Don, we see a lot of these set up in second marriage situations. Mm-hmm. We see a lot of them with individuals who are doing some advanced estate planning where they want to have an irrevocable trust and make a gift right away. And there are certainly some great features with an irrevocable trust, but the one you're going to see 99 times out of 100 would be the revocable living trust. Those are far more common. But even at death, there are many provisions in that revocable living trust that immediately make it irrevocable. So the trust world is a complex place, and I would encourage the caller to meet with, to grab her husband and go meet with the attorney that drafted the document, and they can certainly help walk you through all the ins and outs.
The whole world you live in is a very complex place, as I have to tell you. It is very complex indeed. Let's take another call. We'll bring in Bob calling from Kirkwood. Go ahead, Bob. You're on the air.
Hello, sir. This is slightly different. I have a small manufactured lake house over at Carlisle Lake, and we had pipes freeze up and then later on mold set in with significant damage, significant. And the insurance, of course, is in the process of getting it all analyzed now. But as best I can figure out, that I'm still going to have a considerable amount of money that I'm going to have to put out of my pocket over and above the insurance cost. I mean, the insurance award. So my question is, let's just take a round figure that, let's say that I lose 10 grand. I mean, I've got to come up with 10 grand of my own money, in order to get the thing replenished. And that's would be, in addition to the insurance award that I do get. What percent of that 10 grand of my own money that I end up having to put out can I write off? There was mold involved and things of that type.
So what you're going to have on your return will be a casualty loss, and it'll be a personal casualty loss because it's not through a trade or business. And a personal casualty loss is deductible, but it has to get up over a floor. And that floor is $100 plus 10% of your adjusted gross income. So if your adjusted gross income is, say, $50,000, then you'll have that $5,000 floor to get over plus the $100. So you'll have roughly $4,900 of a deduction. And I believe the form where you're going to claim that loss, I think it's a 4684, but it might be a 4864. I can't keep all these form numbers in my head anymore. But I think it's a form 4684 is where you'll figure out how much of the casualty loss is deductible.
Thank you, sir.
Hang on just a second.
Sure.
What's that form number again?
I think it's a form 4684. If you email the show and they forward it to me, I can reply back to that and make sure that's the form number. But I think it's form 4684.
I have had a tax person do my taxes for years. I've got rental property as well.
Great.
So, I have had them do that. So let me be clear. If my adjusted gross income is, say, 50, and I've got a what was that $500 amount? What was that amount?
It's a 10% threshold. So a personal casualty loss is only deductible to the extent it's bigger than 10% of your adjusted gross. So if your casualty loss is 10 and your adjusted gross is 50, the first 5,000 is not deductible, but the next 5 is.
Bob, thanks so much for your call. Let's take another one. This is Tim joining us from O'Fallon. Tim, go ahead. You're on the air with Lance Weiss.
Good afternoon. Yes, I received a letter from my accountant asking if I would like to purchase the electronic filing PIN selection program for filing my 2015 federal tax return. Is that something that is required now, or is it something I do or my accountant does?
Well, so the PIN, the personal identification numbers, were issued by the IRS to all of those individuals who filled out and sent in a form 14039 really any time in the last year or so. And the form 14039 is the identity theft form. So if you've had a credit card hacked or maybe your tax return from last year bounced back, then there's a you've been subject to the tax identity theft issue that so many have been. So you file the form 14039, you get the PIN number, and the theory is that that'll make the processing of your 2015 tax return much, much faster. Now, everything with theory and the IRS gets involved and all the bureaucracy, we haven't seen that really come out into fruition yet. In fact, the IRS system on PIN numbers was itself hacked. So there's so much identity theft going out there. And I'm not sure what the product is that he's talking about you purchasing, but it's a time-consuming process to do the 14039. So maybe he's just offering a bulk pricing deal to do those.
Along these lines, we have an email from Madonna who writes that she was hacked twice and ultimately got a refund from the IRS. I'm paraphrasing her long email here, but she says her question is, do they ever get the money back that they paid out in fake refunds?
Well, the IRS can try, and I'm sure they'll forward it on to the FBI and the Justice Department, and they'll try to get that money back. But the individual won't take the loss. The government's certainly taking the loss, so I guess we all share that as taxpayers. But I'm sure the emailer hopefully eventually got her correct refund.
Right. Okay, 382-8255 is the number. We have some lines open if you'd like to call. Let me, as time allows, let me give you some what I would call quick hits here, some of the things I've seen that are a little bit different. We've talked about some of them. Tax brackets are going up slightly this year?
Yeah, every year they're indexed for inflation. So the highest bracket now starts at on a married filing joint return, $464,850. So they do index these. The 10% bracket now goes all the way up to $18,450 on the married filing joint return. So they are automatically indexed a little bit and do increase slightly each year.
So pay attention, folks.
And again, that's another benefit of the software. I mean, when Ronald Reagan came in 86 and talked about tax simplification, what he did was he changed the math. And he talked about, I'm going to take these 12 different rate brackets and turn them into two. Well, nowadays, simplification has a completely different meaning because everybody has software to do all this math.
Another one that I have here is standard deductions are increasing.
Yeah, they do. And again, that's another one that's indexed for inflation every year. So the standard deductions now on a married filing joint return are $12,600 and on the single return, $6,300. And Don, I tell you what effect that has on so many people with interest rates being as low as they are. And as our client base gets a little bit older, their mortgage balance gets smaller and their interest deductions get smaller. We have more and more of our clients every year take the standard deduction because it's bigger than their itemized deductions.
Really?
Yeah.
Funny. Another call. We'll take this one from Crestwood. It'll be Dale. Go ahead, Dale. You're on the air.
Yes. I had a question regarding amended 1040s, the 1040X, I believe it's called.
Right.
The amended tax return. There's a three-year time frame where you can go back and amend a federal tax return. How is that timed? I know it's 3 years from the date that the that the tax return was originally due, so that may have been the 15th or it may have been later during certain years. But does my amended return have to be just postmarked within 3 years, or does the IRS have to have that physically in their hand within 3 years?
So what you're going to want to do is send that with certified mail and a return receipt requested so that you have the evidence that, in fact, it did hit the mailbox by that date. The postmark alone won't be enough, and your word against theirs won't be enough, but that's why the certified mail receipt is so important. So it is the mailed date.
So it does have to be postmarked, but you have to be able to somehow substantiate that.
That's exactly right.
Okay. I appreciate your information.
Thanks for the call. Are we really to believe there's somebody in the IRS who is checking postmarks?
Well, yeah, they do. And oftentimes in an audit, they'll actually bring back in the original envelope
really?
That the return was mailed in. So somewhere, someplace down, there's a big warehouse full of a bunch of paper.
And a bunch of people checking postmarks. Let's take another call. We'll bring in Art calling from Maryland Heights. Go ahead, Art, but make it quick, please. We're running out of time.
Thank you for taking my call. I just quickly wanted to say, Don, that I'm a big fan and a longtime listener.
Great.
And my question has to do with the fact that last year I was working in California, and I worked there for about 6 months. I had health insurance with my company out there. It was Google, actually. And then I moved back to St. Louis. When I moved back and got a different job, I had a brief lapse in health insurance, about 3 months. I was wondering, how do I report that to the IRS, and will that cause me to take a fee either in part or in whole?
Okay. So that information is going to be relayed on the form 8965. And, you know, Art, I'm a little bit embarrassed because there is a grace period on the health insurance penalty, and I can't recall if it's 2 months, if it's fewer than 3 months or 3 months is the grace period. So the form 8965 will walk you through that penalty relief calculation. And then what you'll need from Google will be either the 1095B or the 1095C showing the months that you had insurance. But I know for sure it's at least a two-month waiver on the penalty, and it might be three. I can't recall that on top of my head.
All right,
okay, great. Thank you. If I could just do one quick follow-up. If it is past that deadline, past that grace period, do I have to pay the entire fee or just part of it?
No, it's a per-month penalty calculation, so hopefully it won't be too much.
Okay, thank you so much.
All right, thanks for the call. I'm going to try one more. John in South County, it's your turn, but we have to move quickly.
Thank you for taking the call. This is just a philosophical question. I'm an engineer. I've got a graduate degree, and yet every year when I do my taxes, I just struggle like crazy to figure it out. And it just real quickly, it seems reasonable that as a citizen of the country, I shouldn't have to hire a tax accountant to do my taxes for me. It should be simple enough that I could understand it and do it all myself. And every year I think, you know, I almost feel like the government ignores this concern. So I'm curious what your guest thinks.
Well, it certainly is a complex arena. And, you know, for all those individuals who are investors in partnerships and some of these flow-through entities that do some of the complexities that are out there, I would encourage them to hire a professional. But, Don, you and I have talked about how good some of the software is that's out there and the free file. And the tax law is full of simultaneous equations that I'm sure that engineer just absolutely loves to go through and the mental exercise of making them all work. But the software out there is so good that it really does make most returns pretty simple.
Do you see anything out there in just a few seconds left that makes you think that we're going to come down to a much simpler tax form at some point?
You know, I do, and I think it's some of the super high income level of level of tax planning, let's call it that, instead of level of abuse that might occur with regard to some of the flow-through trust and partnership type issues, that I do see some simplification coming from that. But it's not going to help 99% of the world. It's going to help those that are, one of them might be running for president. I don't know.
Well, that might be. Lance Weiss, thank you so much. Great seeing you again. The time goes by too quickly, but thanks for
it
being
does.
With
thanks
us.
For having me.
This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.